becoming cured. Ken Howard will be arrested at some point. Recovery is not possible. Thank you for letting me.
Thanks all for that. So at this time, I'd like to introduce our first speaker, named John Yim on the law there.
Hello, beautiful people. I'm John. I'm an addict. Let the truth be told, I am an addict. I have to surrender to that fact every day, every single day. It's a reality. First and foremost, I'd like to thank my higher power, whom I choose to call God, for allowing me to be here today. If it wasn't for him, I wouldn't be here for sure. I very much understand that now. I say the Serenity Prayer every day to remind myself to keep conscious contact with my higher power. Always. It's proven to be the most important thing in my life. Awareness that I have of a loving and kind higher power in my life that wants the best for me. I'd like to thank all the wonderful folks that put this convention together. It's incredible. I've been walking around looking at things. I've been coming to this convention for the last 7 years. I stay active in this convention too. I saw a button that a recovering addict was wearing. It says, "Be the we." Those are the people who tirelessly submit their time to these conventions and the other efforts and other events that happen in Narcotics Anonymous. We're all beautiful people. Today's topic is, and help me out here, it's never alone and
never again.
Thank you. Thanks. That's right. Thank you for being here and participating in my recovery. You know, we're all part of each other's recovery here. That's what we're here for. Help each other. Do you know what alone means? I looked it up in the dictionary today to make sure I understood. As I was taught in this program, I looked a lot of things up. I want to understand. It means separate, apart, isolated from others, solitary, solely, only, exclusively, without aid or help. Without aid or help. Wow. That's a painful place to be. And I know that you all know what I'm talking about, too, when I say that. We probably wouldn't be here. It's a great honor for me to be here. I'm filled with good emotions and good vibrations from this convention. That's coming from you guys. You know, I can feel it. Thanks for sending your love my way. I can, you know, and it's helping me feel good. It's helping to take away my fear. I'm not alone. Never again. We talked about myself for a second here. My clean date is October 5th, 2005. I have an NA sponsor who has a sponsor. I worked the 12 steps of Narcotics Anonymous with my sponsor. I belong to a home group. It's called Steps by the Beach. It's about 20 miles up north here in the first town of the first state, Lewis, Delaware. And I actively participate in that home group. I've learned to lovingly and freely give myself to recovering addicts, recovering and sick addicts. I had to learn that. That wasn't natural for me when I came here. I didn't have empathy. Recovery takes time. Time takes time. Let me tell you how far this program reaches. I'm an engineer, and I design things for jet airplanes. I learned that in recovery. That's a blessing. With my work a few years ago, I had to fly to a little town in the Netherlands called Bergen op Zoom. It's about 100 miles south of Amsterdam. Flew to Amsterdam, rented a car. They didn't have a GPS. This is my first time in the Netherlands, so I had to wing it to get down to a place 100 miles south of Amsterdam. That was fun. But only 2 days before my trip down there, a good friend of mine in recovery went back out, and he decided to end his life. And he was somebody I was hoping to gain a closer relationship with in this program. We rode motorcycles together. We did charity work together. It broke my heart. Really did. And when I got to Bergen op Zoom and got to my hotel room, I called the lady who asked me to come and speak here today, Deanie. I told her I needed a meeting bad. She told me she had met a person in recovery named Rose that she had met at the World Convention in South Africa, and she passed me her number, and I called Rose from Bergen op Zoom. She lived in Amsterdam, and she was able to describe to me where a meeting was in Bergen op Zoom, and you know, with no GPS in a foreign country, I'm amazed I found it. It had to be God to get me there, because it was actually quite complicated little drive. And when I pulled up in front of it, you know, I saw people going inside a building. I said, this has got to be the right place, you know. So when I went in there, they welcomed me, you know, and I introduced myself. John M., the addict from America. And it was a Dutch-speaking meeting. And when I introduced myself there, they changed the meeting to American for me, and I got my help. And they, you know, I got help 70 miles away. And I really needed it, too. It was an awesome meeting. That Friday night, I drove up to Amsterdam. And I met Rose in person on a Friday night meeting that was loaded with recovering addicts. It was a beautiful thing. You know, for a little while when I was out there, I started to feel kind of alone. And it wasn't true. I had to reach out, you know. This never alone, never again thing like that requires you to do something, you know. And it was a wonderful experience. I've been there again since then, and again, it was a wonderful experience. They've as you know, Amsterdam is one of the things they call drug capital of the world, I think they say. But there are a lot of meetings. There are a lot of meetings. And so I'm originally from the D.C. area. My mother, Clara Sunday, spelt like the day of the week, S-U-N-D-A-Y. She's born in 1934 in Sibley Hospital, downtown D.C. Her family, 8 siblings, they grew up on Peabody Street. Down there later, lived above a bar room on North Capitol Street. She's the most amazing and brave woman I've ever known. She died in 1985 from non-A, non-B hepatitis, as it was called then, and other terminal illnesses combined with alcohol and drug addiction. We buried her 28 years ago, yesterday. That's right, yesterday was the 28th anniversary that we buried her at Fort Lincoln Cemetery in Brentwood, Maryland. Father was born in Northern California, California country boy. His family, giant redwood loggers and boxers. His father was killed when he was 15, a falling giant sequoia that they were cutting down. Hit a tree that was already down in the brush that he couldn't see, popped up, smashed his father against another tree. Killed him instantly. So my father grew up after 15 without a father. This is stuff I've gotten to learn since I've been in recovery. You know, I've been able to do research on stuff that was interesting to me about my family, you know, because growing up in my family was complicated, you know, and when I got into recovery, I wanted to understand more. So why was it so complicated, you know? Where did my family come from? Where did my folks come from, you know? And so it was a interesting journey to find out and I found out, actually I found out a lot more than I wanted to know, you know, but at the same time, now, you know, I feel good about that. I feel good that I know that information. My dad left his home when he was 17 and joined the Navy, fighting the Korean War. Saw a lot of terrible stuff. He was a pharmacist. He was a pharmacist and a corpsman in the Korean War. So he saw some serious stuff. So I grew up in a crazy family. It was loving, fighting, drinking, drugging, fighting, crazy family. 5 of us, a sister and 4 boys. D.C. suburbs, Anacostia, Suitland, Wheaton, Silver Spring, ended up in Kensington, Maryland. My mother was a sick woman, and sometime in the late 60s, she came home with my younger brother, Michael, and it turns out that she had some incurable diseases that were going to take her life from her at a young age. And they only expected her to live maybe 6 or 8 months. They were giving her to live. And she beat the odds for 17 years, but in a terminally ill condition, you know. I spent most of my high school years looking after her. If I wasn't looking after her, guess what I was doing? Drinking and drugging. I wore out my welcome with pretty much all those drugs. When one stopped working and didn't give me what I wanted anymore, I moved to the next. Or I made a combination of it, you know, anything I could do to get out of how I felt, you know, and I felt horrible as a child, just literally horrible. I was confused, scared, lost, to be honest, lost. And You know, I was, I became extreme in my using, and I had to be the best at everything. The best user. What a great shot. What a great thing to go for, huh? I'm the best user, man. So in 2005, my brother George suddenly died of a heart-related conditions, result of many years of drinking and drugging. He was my big brother. He was my best friend. I dearly loved this guy. He was a beautiful person. He helped anybody with anything. 30 days later, I lost my next brother, Steve. Direct result of this disease, accidental overdose. He's 44 years old, had three kids between them. Out of depression from that, I tried to use myself into the grave. I was already a very heavy user. That just kicked it into overdrive, accelerated everything. You know. I don't think I was ever seen without a large vodka bottle in my hand. You know, the one thing about alcohol is it's a depressant. You can't cure depression with a depressant. Yeah, my friend that I, the last guy that I used with before I got myself cleaned up, Orlando. And I used to look at him and I say, man, this guy is spent, man. I said, I'm never going to be like that guy. I don't know anybody that bad. You know, he's the last guy I was using with. He called me Giazzani. He goes, Giazzani, man. He goes, I can't use with you no more, bro. He goes, you scare me, man. He goes, you're going to die. He goes, I don't want to be around when you die, man. I was like, come on, man. What are you talking about? You're my last hope here, you know? Screw it. I'll do it just by myself, you know? And I wound up a very, very lonely person, all alone, you know? And I found myself, for the most part, stuck in a bathroom, you know, sitting on the floor, a drug of choice, a weapon, a phone with 911 dialed on just in case I started to have a coronary. What a way to live. I was very alone. I was very unhappy. I was very sad. And one morning, I came walking out of that room, and my wife started yelling at me. And in my weakened mental state, and spiritual, physical, and weakened mental state, I lost it. I just said the most horrible stuff that I could think of. All at once. Screamed it at her. Was so messed up in the head, I took something off of the wall. I said, man, this thing is like got evil in it or something. And I took it in the stove and I burned it on the stove. Watched it flame. I was like, bye-bye. And, you know, and I sat there and I thought to myself, God help me. God help me. What am I going to do? And I, you know, I heard a voice say, you're sick, John. You are sick. And all of a sudden I went, I'm sick. No kidding. I really am sick. And I was so alone. And I couldn't think of anything. You know, I isolated myself from everybody. And I was trying to finish off my relationship with my wife. I was like, if I can just get rid of her, man, and nobody to tell me what to do anymore. She didn't tell me what to do anyway, you know? I still maintained a job. These guys didn't tell me what to do. I come in there, man. I used to sleep under my desk. I throw towels under me, man, so nobody freaking knew I was there. You know? And it was bad. You know? Occasionally people caught me under there. You know? I come out and say, oh, man, I had an allergic reaction or something. You know? I had a story for everything. Lying, cheating, trying to fool everybody. You know? So standing in my living room that day, I had about that much left of a second half gallon of vodka. And I said, man, I need help. I need help bad. And all of a sudden, something just popped in my head. I called my dad. I thought I'd been hiding everything from everybody for so long. You know, I didn't, I really did not believe that anybody knew what I was doing, you know. I did some secretive stuff when I was in the service, so I thought I was pulling it off in this civilian life, you know. It's like, oh, I had a top secret clearance when I was in the service, and I did this and that, and I hid this and I hid that. I wasn't hiding anything from anybody as wasted and as messed up as I was. I looked horrible. I felt horrible. It was a horrible existence. And I called up my dad. I said, Dad, I'm sick. He goes, I know. I'm coming over to get you. He didn't say anything else. He goes, I know. I'm coming over to get you. He's an addict and an alcoholic, too. He knew exactly what was going on with me. Exactly. To my surprise. And he rode me over to the Veterans Center, Veterans Hospital, down there on Irving Street, Washington, D.C., downtown D.C. And they threw me in and they said, you need to be detoxed. And, and I remember one of the things, one of the questions they asked me when I walked in there, they said, how are you going to deal with being strapped down 24 hours a day? What? I'm not going to deal with that very good at all. In fact, I'll probably fight you. They said, that's all right. We got some big guys around here, and they did. These VA cops, the hips was here. Oh, my God. And then they said, so what are you going to do if somebody approaches you? And I was such a, I just wanted to be in bed. I just wanted to be somewhere safe, away from myself. I wanted to be locked away from myself. And they said, what are you going to do if somebody approaches you? And I was like, what do you mean? They're like, what are you going to do if somebody approaches us? What do you mean if they're going to, like, attack me? And they're like, yeah. I said, I'm fighting this thing, man. You know, I'm gonna fight, you know. So it was a crazy place to be. When I was there, though, I started seeing a glimmer of light of hope, and I started to believe that it was a possibility that maybe I could start to feel better. And a guy came in, he brought an NA meeting in there. His name was Reggie, and he told a story about him and his brother that were using in an abandoned building, and how he went out to get some more, came back and says, I'm going to use this stuff up before my brother wakes up. But what he didn't know, his brother was already laying there dead. And once he figured that out, you know, that's when he started to change his life. His story gave me empathy, you know, and I started to have empathy for addicts. And, you know, when I got out of there, I joined a home group and got me a sponsor. Hell, I called Steve for years. What am I going to do with myself? I didn't know what to do. I had no idea what to do. I was lost. So started working the steps in here. And you know, and I come walking into one of those, come walking into the room, and Mr. Big Guy, I was tough, you know, I was bad. And luckily for me, some of those people in there recognized the type of person I was, and they came over there and they said, man, you cannot do this thing alone, brother. You know, you're going to need our help, you know, like that. Because I didn't want nobody's help. I didn't know how to accept anybody's help. When I was young, I decided that the things that I saw going on around me, warranted me to do things on my own because I didn't like what I saw. And, you know, that was locally in my family. But as I got older, I just expanded it to every other person there in the world. Every person. So nobody tells me what to do. I do what I want to do. And that was the beginning of my destruction. You know, but, you know, after I was in that, meeting, and there I picked a sponsor. Turns out that after I was in there for 6-7 months, I was very sick. Turned out that I had a brain tumor, a big old tumor in my skull back here. And I went to my sponsor, said, "Steve, I got a tumor in my skull." He goes, "It's all right, John." I said, "It's all right. I got a tumor in my skull." He goes, "No, you don't understand. My sponsee just had a tumor removed. I know how to do everything to help you, you know." The never alone, never again thing, man, these guys were there for me immediately and every step. I had, while I was at work after I got cleaned up, I'd lend down, poke my eye, and these guys said a prayer for me, and miracles happened. Lots of miracles have happened to me, you know. I only got a couple minutes left here. I wanted to say something else. I said, remember I said I buried my mother 28 years ago yesterday. She was a courageous, beautiful person. 28 years ago today, I married the most courageous and beautiful person in my life. And it's my wife, and she's still my wife. Today is our 28th anniversary. And I love her, and she has stood by me through all of this stuff. And PTSD that I picked up in the military, drug addiction, alcohol addiction. She shares my recovery with me, and I love the girl, and I want to say happy anniversary to my beautiful wife here. Some flowers that can't be knocked over too easy. I don't have to be alone anymore. And one of the reasons is because I've made friends with myself. I'm my own best friend. I have my higher power. I work on that every single day. And I've got the beautiful people in recovery here. Never alone, never again. Thank you, everybody. I'm John. I'm at it.
Thank you, John. All right, so our next speaker is going to be Ed Kay from the Del Mar area.
Hi, my name's Ed, and I am an addict. I never really think about what I'm going to say beforehand. To give you an idea about my past, this is my second time in recovery. I first got clean in 1990. I'm from this area. I grew up in this area. When I first got clean, there weren't many NA meetings around this area. There were two in this area, one on Monday nights and one on Wednesday nights, down in the Rehoboth Lewis area. And I did real good for the first 4 or 5 years. I went to meetings as often as possible and things, but as I got clean for a while, I stopped going to meetings. You know, life got good. Things got good. You know, and I forgot I was an addict. You know, back then it was more about drinking for me. I grew up at the beach. You know, the beach lifestyle was the way I was born and raised. You know, I grew up around going to the bars. I grew up around doing everything around that. You know, if you were from down here, you worked on the weekends and you went out during the week. You know, during the summertime, you worked your ass off. During the wintertime, you had a nice, easy lifestyle. You know, for the people from around here, you learned to go hunting, you learned to do everything else, and you got a part-time job. you know, but your real money was during the wintertime or during the summertime. You know, and that's how I was raised. I was real lucky. You know, I had money. And I got to live a good life. You know, I had 10 years clean my first time around. I got too involved with business and work and everything else. And I had gotten married, and I was doing really, really well. And I went through a real bad divorce. And one of my friends that wasn't in recovery, because I didn't have recovery friends, saw what I was going through the day things went bad, when my wife at the time emptied some bank accounts and ran up some credit cards real bad in one day, and a few other things, and I was about to go ballistic. And he came and he said, "You need to relax." And he said, "Here, take this." And it helped at the time, because it would have probably been locked up if it hadn't have been for that. But it was the start of a 5-year journey that got really bad. You know, I didn't own the use. I bought and sold drugs on a heavy, heavy level. We'll leave it at that. You know, I bought and sold seafood for 28 years. I didn't sell it on the side of the road. I bought and sold on the Philadelphia market and New York market. I sold to grocery stores. I sold seafood markets. I sold everywhere, and I bought and sold in a big quantity, which meant I got to travel a lot. I got to go down to Florida. I got to go down into South America. You know, so my connections were a lot better than most people could ever imagine. You know, I had easy access to whatever I needed, which meant not just for seafood, for other things. And it made me being able to get high really, really easy, and really, really cheap and really, really convenient. And the biggest problem was I didn't know where to stop anymore. You know, in the beginning it was the lighter drugs, in the end it got to be the worst drugs. You know, it was social, it was acceptable in the beginning. In the end, it was not sociable, and it was not acceptable. You know, it became a lonesome way to get high. I lived on a boat for a long, long time, a 42-footer. That was my home, and that was my own place. You know, it was a place I could get high. I didn't have to worry about people. I didn't have to worry about anybody coming around. You know, I could go out in the water and get high, and who was going to come around? In the end, I was worried about somebody sneaking up underwater on me. That's how bad it got at the end. You know, you can tell somebody that doesn't get high that, and they're like, "You must be fucking crazy." In the end, yeah, I had to worry about somebody sneaking up by water to catch me getting high. You know, never alone. I was always alone. You know, I trusted no one. I had no faith in anyone. I had no faith in myself at the end. You know, I'd been betrayed, yet I had no faith and didn't want to trust anyone again. You know, I'd been through recovery one time, and I didn't even have any faith in recovery again. You know, it was the hardest thing for me to do, was to get clean again. You know, they talk about a lot of things in recovery, and I hear people talk about suicide and things like that, and most people don't understand that. Me, I do. You know, I tried it a few times and wasn't very successful because it was half-assed. And I don't tell the story very often because most people flip the hell out. But the people that know me know what I'm talking about. I got real entangled in some things one night, and I got caught up and an embezzlement thing where I'd taken some money from somebody, and things were going down. And the money wasn't the big issue, but the things that were happening around me were. So I went, got a lot of crack one night, smoked it up, put a gun to my head and pulled the trigger. The bullet went around the inside of my head twice and came out. That's no joke. I see a couple of people shaking their head. And I woke up. I lived on a 42-foot boat with my dog. My dog licked my face and cleaned me up enough that I could wake up and make a phone call. I got off the boat. I called my family and said, I need a ride to the hospital. I locked the boat up, walked down the dock, and got in the car and passed out. After 3.5 weeks of shock trauma, I was able to come home. I had to learn to walk, talk, and everything again. As soon as I did, learned how to drive a car again, I got high again. You'd have thought something like that would have stopped you from getting high, stopped me from getting high. That wasn't enough. You know, it wasn't enough for me to stop getting high. I went to 2 rehabs after that. First one I lasted, I think it was 4 days out of the rehab, and I got high again. Second one, I think I lasted, I think it was maybe 1.5 weeks, and I got high again. The third one, I overdosed on pills, and they locked me up. This one, it was like 2 days before I gained consciousness in the, I forget what they call it. It's called Meadowood or somewhere like that in upstate Delaware. And it was 2 days before I gained consciousness. And when I got out of it, they found a few other things that I had done to myself when I shot myself. And I've been stable, and I've been clean ever since. But I had to put some limitations on myself. I gave my money, my car, everything else to my family to take care of. Put some limitations on myself so that when I went back to my family's house to live, I had to have a set of rules that I lived by and somebody else set. You know, so if you're new into recovery and somebody says, I don't trust this, I don't trust that, understand there's people worried about you. It's not just, I'm clean, I can do this. It means there's people that care that you fucked over in the past and they don't trust what the hell you're doing. You know, shit, if I went out my door, my car knew one direction to go. It went to where the dope was sold. I'm sorry, but it sort of had autopilot on it. You know, and I had to go with never alone, never again. You know, I had to trust the people in the rooms. When I went to the rooms, I picked out some of the biggest people I could find that would knock the living shit out of me to come to my house and pick me the hell up. You know, there were 4 people I trusted when I got into the rooms. You know, and the funny thing is, 3 of the 4 people are still clean today. You know, they don't even live down where I live today. One of them lives in New York, and 2 of them live over in Maryland. You know, but they were the ones that came and picked me up. You know, they'd come to my house. My family had no idea in hell who these people were. And they didn't look like the good people that come in suits and ties. I mean, they were people with tattoos. They were people that weren't always dressed right. They knock on the door and said, we're taking Ed to a meeting. First time my parents met him, like, who the hell are you? You know, and they're like, we're taking him to a meeting. Here's my phone number. Here's my name. Call me if you got a problem. He's coming with us. And they were like, okay, well, what he was doing wasn't working. We'll give it a try. You know, and believe it or not, they became good friends with the people I had to give my faith to. And they care a lot about them today. They're the only people I could trust. They were the only people I had faith in. You know, because shit, I didn't have any faith in what I'd do. You know, and these were people I had never met before. They were good people. You know, and it's something I've turned a lot of faith to today. You know, I was never a real religious person. I've got a lot of faith in God today, but it's not like going sitting in a church every Sunday. That's not my thing. I got in a real heated argument with my sponsor for a long time. I kept saying, put something physical in front of me that shows me God. You know, I'm not one of those people that a Bible thumper or anything like that. I said, I want to see a physical thing. And one day in the afternoon, he called me up and he says, I got it for you. I said, okay, let's hear it. He said, "What woke you up after you shot yourself?" I said, "That was easy. That was my dog." He said, "I spelled the damn thing backwards." I went, "Holy shit." I said, actually what I said was, "You motherfucker, you finally figured me the hell out. I can't answer that one without trying something new." He said, "It works in different ways. Don't look for the hard shit. Figure out that there's different ways your higher power will work for you. Then stop being a hard-headed son of a bitch and figure out that it comes in many different terms." After that, I had no problem figuring out that my higher power works in a lot of different ways. If I look past the stupid shit, I'll find it. You know, and since then, I've seen tons and tons of things happen. You know, it's the little things you got to bypass. You know, my friend over there was talking about, I've seen a lot of tragedy since I've been clean. You know, I had somebody come to me one night that was in a ton of pain, and I watched somebody shoot themselves right in front of me. I was able to keep them alive for about 20 minutes before the state troopers got there. And then they lost him twice in front of me, and I about kicked the shit out of them until they could get him back in the ambulance. They weren't real happy with me that night, but it was me that kept him alive. The longer you're clean, the longer you'll see some bad shit happen. But if you're faithful and determined, you can stay clean. This is not an easy disease to beat. It is one of the hardest things I've ever fought in my life. But I fight every day to stay clean. You know, I heard somebody say in a meeting one time, I can lose my clean time in the same amount of time it takes to strike a match. And that was the thing that hit me the hardest. I'd love to remember who told me that. But that's how long it would take me to lose my clean time if I wasn't careful. You know, that's how long it took me to get high. You know, I can remember sitting in a room with a bunch of people getting high. And every time somebody lit that match, I was like, damn, that could be me. You know, and then somebody else would light it. My hands would start itching. You know, today I don't have to worry about that shit. You know, I've seen it happen time and time again at different places. It's not me anymore. It's amazing how much difference it can be. I do a lot of charity work for rehabilitation. I mean, they pay me, but in my book, it's charity work for what the state pays. And I watch people that have the option of either going to jail or getting the chance to stay clean. And I see a lot of people get the option to stay clean that do make it rather than go to jail. And they get a chance for a second chance in life where they don't have it on their records and don't have this and don't have that. You know, excuse me. And it makes a world of difference in not having to deal with that for the rest of their life. You know, because I know what it's like. You know, with the felonies on your records and things like that. Nowadays, you can't get jobs. Nowadays, you can't do a lot of things. You know, with the option to get out of it, you have an option that could affect the rest of your life. You know, it's amazing. I see kids, they have an alternative thing up where I live, and kids are in this thing when they should be in high school. You know, we didn't get high when we were in elementary school. I didn't get high until I was in high school. And that was, you know, go out and smoke a joint. These kids are smoking crack and everything else in high school. I didn't even know about crack until 10 years ago. And I'm a little bit older than high school. You know, the grade gives it away. You can tell I don't like speaking at a microphone. It's a lot different today. You know, I talk about it with friends all the time. If I don't show up at meetings on a regular basis, there'd be people knocking on my doors going, "What the hell's wrong? What's going on?" You know, I've been sick all week. I'm getting over bronchitis. And I had a lot of people call me, you know, "Why weren't you at the meetings? What's up? You know, what's going on?" Those are the kind of friends I need to Because if something isn't going right in my life and I don't hit meetings, they know. You know, and it, because I'm sick, that was one thing. But if I was out using or had a problem and stopped going to meetings, I'd want somebody to find me. Because if I'm getting in trouble, all hell is going to break loose. You know, I did it before, I'll do it again. You know, it doesn't matter how much clean time anybody's got. They can go back out in a heartbeat. You know, and I've always said that. Some of the times I'm in a meeting, I hear the best information from somebody that's got a couple weeks clean, more than somebody that's got 10 years clean. You know, some people with 10 years clean say the same thing again and again, where the ones with new time tend to tell you what it's like when you're out there again. You know, and I'd rather hear that because I don't want to have to forget what it could be when I go back out on, if I got back out on the street. Because I don't think I'd ever make it again. You know, last time was scary enough. It can be a rough time. You know, with what I do in service work, I get reminded every day of what it's like. I hear about people nowadays taking care of their their brothers and sisters because their parents are using. You know, they got caught up in it, but they're getting clean. You know, I love to see shit like that. You know, when the parents are so far out of control that the kids are taking over the family responsibilities. You know, that's why we say together we can. People like that are more than willing to step out of the way and help. You know, and it's not just me, it's other people in the rooms that help them. They come up with places for them to rent. They come up with food for them. They come up with almost everything. You know, the fellowship has more strength in numbers than you can actually, you'll ever believe. You know, I don't know what the other areas are like, but I know our area down here at the shore has got strength unbelievable with just about everything. You know, people come together and do whatever they can for people that are trying. You know, and I've seen it time and time again. You know, I know when I needed the help, they were there. And today, whenever I need something, it's not one, it's tons of people. I know there were people moving into a new home not long ago, and they had probably 20 people help them move. Trucks, trailers, everything. You know, you tell me another organization that is like that anywhere. Half the time I think my family needs something like a 12-step program. You know, actually I think most of the people in this country need a 12-step program of some type. Anything would do them better than what they do out there in regular life. You know, this is a program that teaches people in recovery how to live and enjoy life. You know, it's not about money, property, prestige, any of that. It's about learning how to live and enjoy life again. You know, that's what set me back the first time. It was all about money. It was about what other people thought. Today, it's about what I enjoy, what I can do to help others, and what others want to see, you know, what I want to see. You know, I don't really care what anybody else thinks, as long as I'm doing properly. It's a nice way to live today. You know, and the funny thing is, as long as I'm doing the right thing, it seems to go the right way. You know, you put the right foot, one foot in front of the other, and it seems like life goes right one day at a time. You know, it's a hard thing to explain. You know, it's like just for today. Every day is a gift. And for those that don't know how to enjoy it, keep coming back. It'll get better. I'm never any good at time things, and I can barely see the thing. How much time we got? Huh? 5 minutes? Oh, geez. Yeah, that's a good thing because I'm lost for words, but I'm all right. I don't know. It's funny. You know, friends are one of the best things you can ever find in the rooms. You know, I've had a few sponsees, and the best part is I don't bug them. They generally call to do their step work, but the best thing is they call when they got problems. You know, I'm not one of those sponsors that sits there and hounds the hell out of somebody. I'm one that lets them work through their own problems, and then they generally call when things go bad. You know, but that's what it's all about. I have more friends than sponsees, and that's the best part. If you don't make friends in the rooms, you won't know where to go when you've got problems. You know, one of the best things I have is a step study group that I go with that is men only, where we can sit and talk and everything stays in that room. We have a policy in our men's step study group that anything said in there stays in there. And if it goes outside the group, we all like you, but you aren't welcome back. It's a confidentiality thing that gives you the opportunity to say what you need to say. And no, it's not going any further. You know, something like that is hard to find. Because you know, I always say in a meeting, what you hear here, stay, leave it here. With a lot of people, sometimes that's difficult. You know, but you need to find some place where you can share what you need to share. You know, either that or share with your sponsor. Because the dirt that you need to get rid of, find a place to get rid of it. If you don't, it'll always be hanging over your shoulders. You know, a guilty conscience is not something you need to live with. Sooner or later, you got to let it go. If you don't, it will always be there nagging at you. Believe me, I know. I had a lot of guilt. I was lucky. I got rid of mine to one of my sponsors. I know it'll never go anywhere. Rest his soul. And I didn't do it. But I had a lot of faith in him. And I know he never shared it with anybody else. I've been real blessed. I've had 4 sponsors. 3 of them, well, one left the state and 2 passed away. You know, each one and I got along really well. If you don't have a sponsor, find one. You know, don't just go pick somebody randomly. Make sure you can get along with them. Because you aren't going to tell somebody you don't know what you need to talk to them about. It will be a very difficult situation if it goes that way. You know, I like the topic they had, never alone, never again. Because if you're alone, you're going to get high again. So, I think we're close enough, aren't we? Thank you for letting me share. Have a good convention.
All right, thanks, John and Ed. If anyone wants to come up and share, they're free to do so.